Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
This podcast is brought to you by Plan Academy. Plan Academy is the world's leading learning site for anyone working in construction project management or project controls.
At Plan Academy, you learn construction planning and scheduling theory, how to master scheduling software like Primavera P6, and even advanced construction scheduling techniques.
Plan Academy's courses are 100% online and at your own pace. You can learn at the office, at site, from home, anywhere. Get $75 off any Plan Academy course by visiting planacademy.com/chatter. That's planacademy.com/chatter.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by JustDo.com. JustDo is a great business and project management tool we've been using here at Project Chatter.
I agree, Val. I like to keep things simple and JustDo is perfect for that. But I do know it's got a lot of powerful functionality as well. And one of my favorites is the task-specific chat.
Absolutely. And for all you slackers, don't wait for Monday. Check out JustDo.com. Now on with the pod.
Hello, project people. You're listening to the smoothing sounds of the Project Chatter podcast, and I'm your host, Val Matthews. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Mr. Dale Fung.
Soothing sounds, Val.
Soothing sounds today.
All right. Maybe not us, but maybe our esteemed guest. Yeah. But hi, folks. Hi, Val. I hope everyone is well. We have a very special episode today, Val, don't we?
Agree. I'm with you, Dale. Just a reminder before we get into it to our listeners to hit that subscribe button on whichever platform you listen to your good podcasts on and our new YouTube channel for the full podcast and our guest bonus Q&A. Also, this episode is brought to you in collaboration with the Project Controls Expo. And today we're joined and honored to be joined by Dr. David Hewlett, who will be speaking to us and speaking at the UK event in November. Head on over to projectcontrolexpo.com. to register for this amazing annual event. Dr. David Hewlett, great to have you on the pod, sir. Nice to meet you.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. It's our pleasure. On this pod, we will be chatting to David about risk and its colorful forms and risk project analysis. But before we get into that, here is Dale with David's bio.
Cheers, Val. So hold on tight to this. This is an amazing bio. I don't think it covers it all, but Just wait till you hear this. So Dr. David Hewlett is recognized as a leader in developing concepts and methods for quantitative project cost and schedule risk analysis and applying them on large commercial and government projects. He has conducted many project risk analysis and has developed and presented training courses focusing on quantifying the risks and their implications for project cost and schedule results. He works with companies developing the most modern, sophisticated, powerful, and fast software for schedule and integrated cost schedule risk analysis using Monte Carlo methods. He has performed many schedule assessments, benchmarking schedules against GAO's scheduling guide best practice. Dr. Hewlett was admitted as a Fellow of the Association for the Advancement of Cost Engineering, AAC International, in 2015. He received the Brian D. Dunfield Educational Service Award from AAC in 2018. Wow, David, I'm sure there's so much that's missed out from there, but what a great introduction. And as Val says, what a pleasure to have you on the pod. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. I'd love to talk about project risk analysis with people and particularly people with various backgrounds so that they can contribute as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we know, the main reason for us doing this pod is to share. And so thank you for that. I just want to, before we get into it, though, I want to know, I mean, you've done so much more than that bio that I read out suggests. Can we perhaps delve into that a bit and perhaps the origin story, some of the highlights that weren't mentioned there? Because I know there's far more than what it suggests.
Sure. Started out with a PhD from Stanford in economics, which includes modeling and quantitative quantitative kind of things. Taught for a couple of years at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Went down to the Washington, D.C. area where I did a lot of monetary economics research, econometrics, with the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, because they were building a big, big model of the United States. Went over to the Office of Management and Budget, which is our budgetary office in the U.S. government, to do some public policy stuff. I mean, the public policy stuff, but having to do with collecting, coordinating, budgeting for federal statistics programs. I went over to the Federal Energy Agency that became immediately the Department of Energy and spent about 3 years there. It wasn't great. I mean, you know, at the beginning of any new huge organization that collaborates a whole bunch of parts, everybody is scrapping for turf and budget and personnel and all that. So a friend of mine asked me if I would come join him in Los Angeles at a company called Tosco, which is an oil shale company. It's had some refineries, but fundamentally they were excited about developing oil shale from into shale oil, and they had property and a process that they could do it with, and in the western slope of Colorado, and Exxon was our partner.
Wow.
But in about 1982 or so, the oil prices went down, and that project became less than economically efficient, and so Exxon pulled out, and we pulled out very quickly then too. I worked for a while at TRW, an aerospace company, and in 1990 I started to do some private consulting, some consulting on my own, and fairly quickly got involved with project management. And project management software, particularly attempting to use statistical terms and statistical relationships to try to figure out what a project's really going to cost. Because obviously, when you've got a cost estimate and a finish date from the plan, you're just halfway there. You don't know how much it's really going to cost and how long the plan is going to take. And by the way, you don't even know which risks you ought to be thinking about and mitigating. So I started that, and I got involved with some of the software that was being developed in this area in the late 1990s. And so in the end of 1990, I was working in risk analysis, mostly at that time for cost risk analysis, because the schedule risk analysis stuff, the software was not really ready as far as I could tell. Or at least if it was, I didn't know very much about it. And I didn't know very much about scheduling. So that was the reason. But pretty soon, a client asked me, well, could you do a cost risk and a schedule risk? And I said, I know better than that. I'll integrate the two. And I didn't know what I was going to do, but I said, I realized that schedule is going to have something to do with cost. That is, if an activity takes longer, it's going to cost more because there are resources like people and rented equipment, things like that, and accommodations and all that, that if they're used more, they're going to cost more. So there was a fairly strong link between the schedule results and the cost results. And I did work on aerospace and defense, you know, satellite programs for the U.S. Air Force and chemical plant for various people. Well, no, at that point it was pharmaceutical plant and for Wyeth Erst in Rhode Island. And then pretty soon I ended up with an idea that oil and gas would be a good prospect for me. So let's start there. So one of the very first oil and gas companies I worked for was ConocoPhillips, international oil and gas company, very big, very powerful, a lot of projects going on. They were one of the first things that I got involved with was that they were building a greenfield refinery project on the western coast of Saudi Arabia called the Yanbu Export Refinery Project. And they were joint venturing with Saudi Aramco, and they wanted to know what the risks were of that project. And I got involved with a colleague, a gentleman who is now a colleague of mine, and and an associate of mine. And we did two or three times risk analysis of that project. Ultimately, ConocoPhillips pulled out for some reason, probably not associated with my analysis. And I think Total now has it. But anyway, that got there. And then interestingly, a training opportunity occurred in project risk analysis and management. A very general training opportunity occurred at Petrobras in Brazil, the national oil company of Brazil. And so I went down there and I did some training, and pretty soon they wanted me to do some risk analysis of an offshore production platform. And then they wanted me to do risk analysis of the FPSO, couple of FPSO ships that they had. And it was really good. And of course, they put me up on Copacabana Beach. Well, nice. not the best hotel over there, but certainly a hotel that was actually on Copacabana. And if you want to like to walk a little bit, you can walk from there to Ipanema and see the girl from Ipanema. If she's still there, she's probably in her 80s now. And I really enjoyed Petrobras. Unfortunately, of course, they figured out what I was doing, that they could do it themselves, or at least they think they can. I keep in touch with them a little bit, but that was a while back. And then one of the next, and perhaps one of the most interesting customers has been Petronas, the national oil company of Malaysia. You've heard of the Petronas Towers, big, tall buildings, used to be the tallest in the world. And these are those guys. Wow. And, I've had a lot of other things in the middle, construction projects and all that. But this was, again, offshore gas production platforms. And then a pipeline, which was in Borneo. Well, Borneo, yeah, but in the eastern provinces of Malaysia. And then they took me to places like Myanmar before the United States had recognized them again. And Turkmenistan. Have you ever been to Turkmenbashi? I have. Ashgabat. To India, where they had some engineering being done. And each one of these was on a particular project. And to the southern tip of Malaysia, a very Muslim area, where all of a sudden I'm working at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. Yeah, well, that's the way they do it. So, okay, we did that. And right now, I've worked also on LNG projects, particularly risk analysis, a couple of years ago for the Mozambique project that was being done at that point for Anadarko. And then right now I'm working on a claim for the on the project, the ICFIS project, LNG project of INPEX, and it's a claim that has a lot to do with risk analysis. So they contacted me and asked me to be on the team. I've been doing that for a while. So that's really what we're doing. I do teaching, and I've got an associate who's making a class right now for. Piece of software called Safran Risk, which is, yep. I think, the most viable, most developed, and most promising piece of software that's now being offered. Primavera Risk Analysis, or old PERTmaster, is not supported anymore by Oracle. Booz Allen Hamilton had a wonderful product called Polaris, but they decided they weren't a software house. So this is one of the things we do. And I've done some teaching. I've been to Cape Town. I've been to all sorts of places in the Middle East and Southeast Asia. I've done work on chemical plants and oil sands projects up in Calgary. So that's the sort of thing. I have just two or three associates that work with me right now. I've got a couple of them working. And thankfully for the time we are confined to our houses, we could do some of this work even at our own desks. So that is very lucky and very good, and keeps us out of trouble.
Yeah,
so,
no, absolutely.
Anyway, that's the sort of thing I really enjoyed it. I didn't start out to be an international practice, but as you can tell from what I said, I mean, I've been to Europe on a couple of chemical plants and something for the United Nations. I've been to. And I've I've been all over Canada, United States, South Africa, Beijing and Shanghai. You know, that's the sort of thing. Saigon. So, Ho Chi Minh City. So those are the sorts of things that I do and I like to do. And I go to conferences as AACE. I published a couple of books, Practical Schedule Risk Analysis and Integrated Cost and Schedule Risk Analysis. Both those books they used to sell very well. They're about 10 years old now. I don't promise to come out with a second edition, so you don't have to ask that question. and at AACE conferences, I've published about 8 articles in their Cost Engineering Journal over the last decade. So I like AACE as a really serious professional international project management oriented professional society. Seems to me they care a lot about doing things right and the kind of detail that I like to get into. So that's about it. That's where I stand. I'm still enjoying all this and hope to see people in England and in November.
Wow. Well, we could go all over the show, Val, with that. It's what a decorated career. It's honestly such a privilege, Val. But where do we want to start, Val? Do we want to go straight into there? Do you want to dive head first?
I think we should. I think there's, David sent through a great article that he's written, and there's some great highlights in there that we can pull out and have a conversation about, and then perhaps apply them to some of the projects that we know are challenged with risk per se, and maybe some remedies to that. Would be great to get some wisdom from David while he's here, and then come all round about to what can we do in the future with new technology and software, and absolutely, where is risk going in this new digital environment? I'd be interested to take your thoughts on that, David. So I'll start with you, David, Dale, to kick off the questions, and then I'll jump in at some point.
Well, you mentioned that David sent you this article, and it's interesting because you talk about risk maturity levels, David, and the great thing is it starts on level 0. Usually it starts on level 1, but it's great that you acknowledge that there's actually a level 0 where nothing really exists.
There's a story about this, just to break in. There's a story about how this got started. I taught a course in Kuala Lumpur, 2-day course, 3-day course, I don't remember, a long time ago. And about a year and a half later, somebody from Petronas called me and said, we would like to know what our maturity level is for the various divisions of the company. And so I went over there and we developed a survey form with some of their people, and we implemented the survey form at various different places, and we made up a report. And then the gentleman who was managing me at the time, a guy named Jakob Salem, said, well, why don't we give a paper at the PMI conference? PMI, I think it was PMI conference in Sydney, Australia, on this topic. So he developed the title of it, which was Journey Map for Project Risk Analysis Maturity. So I've adopted that for my paper, and that's where it is. But it started with that, and I wanted to give them a shout out for that.
No, that's truly amazing. Give a shout out to whoever you want on the pod. There's no barring of any of that. But
no, that's right.
As we jump in it, so if I just sort of go through the title, so 0 is unaware, 1 is basic risk awareness, 2 qualitative, 3 basic quantitative, 4 modern quantitative, and 5 advanced integrated cost schedule. I wonder if you want to take us through, I mean, we don't really have to worry too, unless you think it's of value starting with 0 where you're unaware. Is there any value of saying actually how does one identify that you're unaware and the dangers of that? Or is it best that we kind of go through how we move through those levels as an organization to understand where we should be?
Well, it's understanding where you are and also understanding where you want to be. And perhaps you want to be at some levels on some projects or some divisions within your company and other levels at different divisions, depending upon how much risk they face. Unaware just means that there are no decisions. Risk doesn't come up in any kind of conversations or decisions. And if it happens, it's always after the fact, and you've got firefighters who come in and get and maybe actually enjoy recovering from a risk that they might have understood if they'd spent 20 minutes thinking about it. But that's really there's really nothing systemic there or systematic there to talk about. And the first level is, well, we know about risk. We think risk is important, but we don't have any systematic way to do it. We may not have anybody assigned to it. We may not have any methodology or approaches. And you'd be lucky if risk gets talked about in the C-suite about making decisions about whether to do a project or not.
Is that an attitude thing towards risk, or is it just we don't know what we don't know, so henceforth we haven't implemented it? Is it an educational thing?
It's a mindset. It's a culture. It's a culture, and this whole paper is about culture. It's not about methodology. It's about culture, which says essentially, we're not aware of that. We've done it all the same for the last 30 years. We don't need any of this new stuff. And you wonder sort of, where did they go to school? Did they go to school in engineering school? Were they exposed to things like risk? Did they go to business school? Were they exposed to things like Monte Carlo simulation, statistics? But apparently not. The next area of level two is qualitative risk analysis. And for some people, this may be enough. For some types of projects, there may be enough. Maybe you got a very short-term IT development project. You probably don't have time, or really the consequence if you're wrong, to put much effort into it. But you end up with this typical probability and impact matrix of red, yellow, green, and five different levels of probability and five different levels of impact, and then red, yellow, and green areas, call it a heat map, if you will, where a risk might have a fairly low impact but a fairly high probability, or a high impact and a low probability, and it might get as we say in Houston, Texas, it might could be a problem for you. And so if you can identify them, that's fine. One of the problems, and this occurs at all levels, is that this ends up being the risk register. And the risk register, by the way, is supposed to have risk responses or risk mitigations, however you want to call it, for the various important risks. And then you ought to have some kind of person to go through and make sure that those responses are well thought out. One of the problems that I see, and that I see a lot, and I think it has nothing to do with software. I mean, most people say, oh, you do risk analysis. What software do you use? And my standard response is, I do risk analysis. It doesn't matter what software you use. That's the sexy part. But fundamentally, there are softwares out there that will help you do it. But if you don't get certain things right, even at the qualitative analysis stage, you're in trouble. And those things include a good, honest examination of the various risks that you face. And in risk workshops, where a lot of people live, you're going to get a group of 20 people or so, and they'll be there for half a day or a day or more than a day. And some of them are very, very, very structured. I mean, Saudi Aramco has a lot of rules and a thick manual about how to conduct risk workshops. But the thing about a risk workshop is you don't get people in a confidential setting where they can talk, they can say things that they won't say in a risk workshop. It has nothing to do with software. We're talking about what is the culture? Is the culture a situation where you say only things that people are willing to hear? Or is it a place where people can say, you know, this is a real risk and we don't really talk about it very much, but if it happens, this whole project is going to cost twice as much, or it's going to fail for technical reasons or, you know, political reasons, stuff like that. I tend to go even developing the risk register or working with existing risk registers. And this is important because you can have an existing risk register and use Active Risk Manager or some kind of Excel spreadsheet and have a person actually responsible for the risk register. But it turns out once you get these people in a confidential interview or one-on-one for a couple of hours, you'll find about risks that they don't have in the risk register. And you wonder, why is that? That some of the most important risks there are, because these turn out to be the important ones. I remember an Air Force guy, this was a satellite program, communications program, I think, that they were doing. And they had an active risk manager, and they had a consultant running it and stuff like that. And he came in and he said, I want to talk to you about some risks that aren't there. And for 2 hours, he talked about three risks that weren't even in the risk register at all. This elaborate superstructure was built, and yet not, they weren't interested in some of these things. And at the end of that, he said, I got to come back tomorrow because I got two more risks for you. So he got five risks that were not on the risk register. And he was not shy to tell me about it. And I say, I won't tell you what anybody else said, or I won't tell anybody else what you said. It's confidential, but I really need to know. And if we don't know the good, bad, and the ugly now, how are we going to deal with this?
Yeah.
And if there's some things that are off limits, let's get them in a situation where they can talk about it and bring it out. And I'm a consultant. I'm supposed to be an independent consultant. And, you know, nobody's going to tell me not to use the risks that I see and that people have collaborated with me individually, one-on-one, to tell me about. These are the risks. And, you know, I'm not going to be managed to ignore some risks. And I've seen that happen in risk workshops, where somebody says, hey, let's talk about this risk. And somebody else says, come out in the hall with me because I want to talk to you seriously about your future with this company. So that's qualitative analysis. And it does do that. One of the other things, of course, is the culture of the company. The three things, and the two of them occur at level three, level two. Level two. These are the data, and then the does management want to know?
Yeah.
And I've been in with project managers who don't want to know. And I've been in situations where the working people, the team members they know various risks. The management of the company or the department of the agency wants to know what the risks are. And the person who doesn't want that information to go up through the company was the project manager. And often the project manager is the stop point where if you mention a particular risk, that person is going to say, I got it covered. Don't worry about it. Don't even put it in. Or if you have a report, he's going to try to manage that report. Then you get into number three, and number three is the first time when you get a model. And this is schedule risk analysis. So I'm going to say we got a schedule, and sometimes we got a 20,000 or even 50,000. Some people, I think some people in Russia love Spider Project, where they're touting their ability to handle schedules of 250,000 activities.
Wow.
And I say, you know, mostly risk analysis is a strategic analysis. And being a strategic analysis, you're not going to get into the detailed depths that some people need. And you don't need 16,000 or 20,000 activities, much less 50,000 or 100,000. And in fact, if you have that many activities, I'll tell you one thing, and this is the third leg of the stool. One is the good data. Another one is the good corporate culture. And the third is a good model. In this case, the schedule. And if you've got a schedule done by a contractor or somebody like that, 20,000 activities, let's say, in my experience, and I'm not unique in this regard. In my experience, schedules of that nature, built that way, are always out of compliance with scheduling best practices. And there are plenty of manuals about scheduling best practices.
I agree with
PMI
that.
Has it, and AACE has it, and the Government Accountability Office in Washington has it. And we always find that those kinds of large project schedules need so much work that they cannot, without fixing, they cannot support Monte Carlo simulation. And that's the major way in which we do risk analysis. So we have to sometimes look at and find a summary schedule or even develop it ourselves. So that's it. Level three just says, okay, these are the 150 or 500 activities or 1,000 activities that you want to analyze. How long would they take? What's their worst case? What's the best case? And what's the most likely case for each one of these activities? It's called activity estimate ranging. And activity estimate ranging is falling out of favor now, but I must admit to you that I did it for five years, 10 years, I don't know. But the problem with that is you don't really necessarily identify the risks that occur, and you don't have a way to talk about the risks as important because they affect more than one activity, maybe 100 activities, 1,000 activities, where they become important only by affecting multiple activities, because you talk about the activities individually. And on the other hand, you can't separate out discrete risks from uncertainty. Uncertainty is background noise that's inherent and may represent some scheduling bias as well as estimating error. And it's relatively modest, but it's always there and can't be reduced. Individual risks have to be talked about with their probability and their impact. And uncertainty happens with 100% probability. But individual risks have probability and impact, and they are described by cause, risk, and effect kind of a structure of the risk statement. You don't do any of that at level three. At level three, you're just talking about which activities take longer and shorter. And some people say this is PERT, program evaluation and review technique. And that just means they haven't read anything about PERT. PERT's worth a lot more than just that. And yeah. In the 1950s and 60s, when we didn't have computers available to us, PERT was a very great improvement, but no more. So even at AAC, we're trying to get away from ranging. So that's it. You can't talk about individual activity, individual risks. You can't talk about the impact of risks because of their probability or their impact or their impact on multiple activities. And so you do get a histogram, looks pretty much like a normal or a log normal distribution. And you can find out what is the 80th percentile likelihood of finishing. That is the percentile where it's 80% likely you'll finish on that date or earlier. And you may be a fairly conservative company. I've worked on companies that do 70th percentile. On some cases we do 90th percentile. But that's, you do get those. But the methodology, the underlying story about that is, it's really not good. So you've got to get to level four. And you've got to get to level four because that's where you can distinguish between risks and uncertainty. And that's where some of the software wouldn't handle that. And now, we've got Primavera risk analysis, which is growing old in its old age, going creaky in its old age. And we had Polaris, but that's now we've got Safran Risk. There's Risky Project. There's Acumen Risk. So you can look at these. They allow you to handle uncertainty differently from discrete risks. And the discrete risks can be assigned in most of these to specific activities. And so you got a risk that affects commissioning, or you got a risk that affects piping, or you got a risk that affects land use or site work or engineering. You get a risk that affects procurement, and you can identify those risks, learn from these interviews how important they are, learn from these interviews where they apply, and then at level four in the maturity schedule, maturity model, you can apply them on specific activities. And as I say, on one of them, a chemical plant that I had that was for a client in Germany, I was applying risks to 1,000 activities. You know, some risks had to be applied that way because they were so general and they weren't very probable, didn't have a big probability, and they didn't have a huge impact. But if they happen, they happen on multiple, you know, like for instance, the systemic risks, like for instance, you know, the project team is not up to the task, or the project has started without fully understanding all it's supposed to do. I know projects that have been going for 20 years and still don't have the science and engineering correct. Those are the sorts of things which can affect multiple activities in a lot of different ways. And so in risk analysis at level 4 and level 5, obviously, we can do that. This is schedule risk analysis only in level 4. And at level 4, then, with schedule risk analysis, we can prioritize these risks. I've developed a methodology for prioritizing the risks, very simple, very straightforward, multiple regression, multiple simulations, and picking out which is the most important risk, and then taking that, leaving that out, and doing a simulation on all the other risks and seeing what's the next most important. Because you get an idea about which risks are important and information that management really needs to know, which is, if I mitigate this risk, it'll save me how many days? Well, most of the tornado diagrams were based upon correlation between something and something else, but activity, duration, and the finish date. But somebody says, oh, I tell you what, give me $5 million and I'll reduce your correlation coefficient from 60% to 30%. And management says, you know, what's that in American money or whatever country you're in, right? What's that in money that I can tell my shareholders? So what I'm doing is saying, with at level 4, I can say, if you fully were to mitigate this risk, you would save 30 days or 60 days or 40 days or 20 days or nothing at all, you know, because there are parallel paths that are just as risky. Or by the way, by the time you get to this risk, you're already being dominated by uncertainty, which you can't mitigate. That's the sort of thing that leads to something that's very important, which is the mitigation workshop. And I know that there are a lot of different ways to handle risk, but let's call it mitigation for need of a single word. This is actually not individual confidential interviews. This is a workshop because people have to agree. The owner has to agree. The contractor has to agree. Sometimes the principal subcontractors have to agree. There have to be agreement from people who organize things like health and safety and security, or people that get your environmental permits and stuff like that. If you're going to work late at night, you may have community things to worry about, things like that. And so you might get into a mitigation workshop and I say, well, here's the first risk. And if you were to mitigate this entirely, you'd save 2 months. And so you, the owner, get your people together and you, the contractor, in another room, and you talk about these risks in this order. And then you say, okay, what about getting together after lunch, after a box of pizza or something like that? And we will see what you came up with and see if we can merge the two and see if we can come up with a program. Oh, and by the way, if you can tell at the same time how much this mitigation is going to cost, at that point you say, well, if it's going to cost a certain amount, is it worth it to me? Do I save enough days to make that worth it to me? And that's the kind of information that the management needs to get. And by the way, one of the things that we've done and that I did with a colleague about 13, 14 years ago, and I 15, is develop something called the risk driver. And this is a way to look at an individual risk in a way that it can, its impact, the probability is okay, but its impact can be talked about in terms of multiplicative factors. So if it affects the entire construction phase, let's say. So the construction phase is a year and a half. And so that's 18 months. And they say, well, if this risk happens, the construction phase is going to be 20% longer. Or maybe if this risk doesn't happen, maybe it has an opportunity tail to it. Maybe instead of 18 months, it could be 16 months. Well, you've got a lot of activities there that make up the construction. And you would like to make sure that when you apply this risk, that the result, this risk all by itself, and make it 100% likely, because they've told you the probability in a separate statement. So this is the impact, 100% likely. You apply it to all those activities, which is 1,000 activities in that one schedule I was talking about. And you say, oh, wait a minute. some of these are long and some of these are short. So we make a multiplicative factor. So if the risk occurs, it might be have as much as a 1.15 multiplier. And that will apply to all the risks, all the activities, long and short. And if you do it the right way, they become correlated, and the whole construction activity is 15% longer because of the way you've done it. Then this is called risk drivers, and we got PERTmaster to put it into their software in about, I guess, 2004, something like that, 2005 maybe. They called it risk factors because it was the multiplicative factor is the distinguishing feature. And then I have encouraged Booz Allen Hamilton in developing Polaris. And I didn't have to encourage Safran Risk because it's being developed and advised by the people who we worked for 15 years ago, because they came from PERTmaster, and now some of them are actually working for Safran. So they had it already. So this is great stuff. And you can actually figure out, okay, if I do this, I'm not going to really completely mitigate this risk. I may reduce the probability from 70% to 20% and reduce the impact from this wide to this wide in terms of multiplicative factors, but never a whole. And by the way, it'll cost $7 million or a lot of people want it to cost 20 cents, because they really don't want to have to justify spending $7 million. They don't know where they're going to get it. Or you have to hire 12 people or something like that. And so this is where the rubber meets the road. Are you willing to do that for whatever benefit you get? And we can model a before and an after. Before the mitigations and after the mitigations. And we often find that, or we sometimes find that after these mitigations, which are thought about for a day, or maybe we have two or three mitigation workshops and raise it to the higher levels of the executives in the organization, we still don't have a viable finish date, level four. At that point, we go back to the scheduler and say, look, you got to do something structural to the schedule. Like, for instance, add a night shift. Add 7 days instead of 6 days a week or something like that. Or, put some things in parallel that were in series. Things like that. Because we can't get anywhere with the current plan the way it is by mitigations. So that's another thing that's not really risk stuff, but it may be required to get it down. And then you have to say, okay, I've taken account of this and taken credit for these risk mitigation actions. Am I actually going to do it? And I got a project right now, which is completing right now, actually. At least phase two is completing. And they hired more people, and they did the evening workshops, evening work or nighttime work. And they got their principal subcontractors to agree to this. And it cost maybe $40 million more altogether. But the slip between where they were supposed to be and where they actually were, even with mitigation, wasn't enough. So they had to do that. And then level five is just doing it all except for cost and schedule. And the idea about cost and schedule, all these things apply, the risk drivers apply, the mitigation applies. We can do uncertainty and identified risks. All that stuff applies. But now we have costs. And often companies, individuals, organizations don't want to put costs on their schedule. The best way I know of it, the best way to do it is putting resources on the schedule. And when you put resources on the schedule, then that's great, except it's a pain in the neck sometimes, so people don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. There are now ways to bring costs into the scheduling environment from an Excel spreadsheet, but then you have to parse them out. You have to distinguish between time dependent and time independent costs. Time independent costs are raw materials, concrete, cement, steel, various other things that it's going to cost what it's going to cost. Yeah. Equipment that's going to be compressors, pumps, valves, electronics, things like that that are going to be installed, air handling units and stuff, where the cost may be uncertain, but not because of schedule. And then everything else, like, for instance, labor, rented equipment, like earth-moving equipment and drilling rigs and things like that, the longer they go, the more they're going to cost you. And I don't care who pays for it at this point. I'm saying just that the more it's going to cost.
Yeah.
So if you distinguish it between time-dependent and time-independent, then the time-dependent risks, they have risks of their own, but they also are, they may have risks for their own. So you might say, well, labor's risky, but its cost is risky because of the economic situation in the country, or the strength of the labor unions or something like that. Well, that's true, but you still have the risk that the workers are going to stay there for an extra 6 months. I mean, you've said it's going to be 6 months over. You know that that's not going to happen during mobilization and demobilization. It's going to happen at the peak of labor required. So you end up saying, okay, well, we'll take an average burn rate, an average daily burn rate. And if it goes longer by 10%, nothing else happens, then it will cost 10% more for the labor. And as I say, the cost of procured items might be greater or smaller, depending upon, for instance, the world price of steel or how busy the fab yards are and things like that. But unless you want acceleration. If you want acceleration, you may have to start paying the fab yards more to get priority. Anyway, so this is an integration of cost and schedule, which is sort of difficult. Although I remember one of the first times I tried it with Petronas, the cost guy came in, and he doesn't exactly rub elbows at lunch with the schedule guys, but he came in with all of his information, and he in about 3 days put the entire cost in on the schedule in resources and time independent resources. I don't need to know the detail of the resources. You tell me it's labor, I don't care if it's high price labor or low or not, as long as we got the right cost. Anyway, so then when you simulate it, you get something called called integration of cost and schedule risk. And at that point, this is sort of the pinnacle of risk maturity. At that point, you can have what's called a scatter diagram of cost and time cost and time together. And that means that you can solve for cost and time. Each one of those points on the scatter diagram represents one solution for both cost and time in your simulation. So if you got 5,000 iterations, there'll be 5,000 points, and they will be a combination of schedule on the x-axis and cost on the y-axis. Turns out to look like a football. Now, you guys, where you, Australia and the UK, you have no idea what I'm talking about because your football is round.
We have a rugby ball.
Our football is old.
We've got Aussie rules. Yeah, it's a cyborg as well. Yeah. We've got Australian rules.
So this is like this, and it says if it costs more, takes longer, it's going to cost more. Not exactly. It's not a perfect one for one. It's a scatter. It's a sort of but you can look at it as a probability, three dimensional shape. Sort of a topographical map, where anything at the top, which is along the ridge of the center line, of the cost and schedule scatter diagram, it's the highest, and that means that it's most likely to happen there along now. What do you want to see? If you want to see something that's no more than 3 months late and no more than $20 million more or something like that, you'll find out by plotting it on the x-axis and the y-axis. It turns out that when you do that, the basic schedule and cost, and this is why we do risk analysis, the basic schedule result and the cost result, finish date and the total budget, without contingency, because we're estimating contingency, are very unlikely to happen, like maybe 5% likely to happen to get both of them together. You say, whoops, that didn't work too well. I would like for I'd like to find all those combinations of cost and schedule that give me a 70% chance of finishing on those combination of cost and schedule. There's a sort of a necklace of cost of points where the cost and schedule are. If it costs more, it can be shorter. If it takes longer, it has to be a lower cost and stuff like that. And it turns out that what you'd like is to be able to tell your boss, here's a cost and a schedule, and I'm 70% confident or 80% confident, whatever your attitude is about risk, that I'm gonna hit those cost and schedule targets. And the boss will say why, and you say why you've done all this stuff. And our NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, has called that the joint confidence level. And I sort of told them how to do this, and then a year later they came up with it and thought they were geniuses. But I'd written my book. I'd written Integrated Cost and Schedule Risk Analysis in 2011, and it was all there. So that's what we have. And actually a friend of mine and I have identified the ridge, the three-dimensional shape of the ridge, at the top of the ridge are all the most probable results. And if you want one that's 70% likely, you want the 70 place where the 70% likely cost and schedule, the sort of necklace, actually hits the highest point on the three-dimensional, the topographical map. And so a friend of mine and I have figured out that there's we can do some modeling and show where that is. So you don't have to guess at it. Turns out that if the cost and schedule are fairly well behaved, nothing like a bimodal distribution or something, a regression line between the cost and schedule, you know, cost is X plus Y times schedule, through the mass of cost and schedule results in the scatter diagram, wherever that meets the 70th percentile or 80th percentile necklace of joint success, that's probably the thing that you ought to go tell your boss, or in our case, an agency ought to tell the U.S. Congress, is that this is our. And it turns out that there's some evidence to show that when NASA started doing this about 6-7 years ago, they've got projects now that have been under this regime and they've gotten finished. And so we know what the answer was. And there's some evidence that they're able to hit their joint confidence level targets much better than they could hit their cost targets and their schedule targets separately. And this is not because they are better project managers these days. They are better project prognosticators. The information has always been there, but now we know how to fix it. So that's that's the top. You may not want to be at that level 5, but if you want cost and schedule risk analysis, you've got to have some of these other things going on. So that's the story. Dave. That's the story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, that was a great overview, and I bet you could have kept going on. It was great just to listen to that as well. I know Dal and I were taking notes, and we'll have to listen to this podcast again. And we'll just remind her again to catch you at the Project Controls Expo, because you're going to have visuals up. So for anyone who found it difficult to kind of follow along with some of the scatter graph diagrams, I think go see Dr. David present, and it'll make a lot more sense to you. I was just picking up a few things while you were talking about the various maturity levels, and I got probably three or maybe two questions I'll talk to. One of them is when we're talking about risk and the areas that Dale and I have worked in, and we synergize with a lot of the conversations and a lot of the challenges that you're having, people are having in organizations and projects around culture, you've got to have good data and a good model, but the culture is what brings it all together. Yes. What forms the association to accountability and obviously provides the quality that you need to do kind of any prediction or forecasting of the future. One of the things I found was sometimes you find people or sometimes you find projects at level 1 trying to do a level 5. And I've seen this. We want and there's a real good push, and it's not bad to be ambitious and aspirational. Like, here's we want to be a level 5. But our whole team are not mature enough collectively to kind of execute that. So I'll get to my question. One of the things in that kind of aspiration or ambition to get to level five is, which we haven't talked about, I don't think yet, is risk contingency. And the two things that I find really interesting on projects that the C-suite and the executives seem to like talking about is my risk exposure, i.e. the kind of the summation of my uncertainty plus my risk register. What does that look like in terms of cost? And generally then my risk contingency, or, you know, it's probably more likened to a bucket is what it's been called or dubbed in the industry, which is not a good thing. It sounds like you can just take it whenever you want. And how we go about managing contingency of risk. And so I thought I might just start with how is the best way to approach risk contingency? I know you do reference it in your article as well, but what's the best way to, one, calculate the risk contingency and then manage it?
Well, the first thing is that in order to do a risk analysis, and I'm going to talk about Monte Carlo simulation here as a methodology, you want to make sure that you're doing it on a contingency-free platform. And so if somebody's put a bunch of lags in their schedule or goosed up their cost estimates to provide them a little cushion, we want to get that out of there because we are actually going to be re-estimating that. And as I say, if you just do cost, for instance, all by itself, or just do schedule by itself, you get a histogram, which is essentially a frequency diagram of all the various results, and you will get a cumulative distribution, and you can find on that cumulative distribution, if you don't do joint confidence level quite yet, what is the 70th percentile or 80th or 30th or whatever. I know some organizations that rely on a 50th percentile result. That's sort of like saying get your resume ready because you may need it. They tend to throw that information to the economics people who don't understand the use of a whole probability distribution shape. But the idea is that you can talk about contingency with some idea that you have used methodologies and you've used people and you've used used software and all that and data collection methodologies that have highlighted the sorts of things that could cause you to overrun your schedule or overrun your cost. And so that's the sort of thing that you need to know. You may very well have an appetite for risk that says, yeah, we're very risk averse on this particular customer, this particular project, or this particular company. And so we want to set a schedule budget for us or a cost budget for us that gives us a 70% chance of being right. And that means it's 70% likely that this will be enough to hold in, you know, but you better go to management and get that money. You know, you got to go to management and get that money before. And that's one of the reasons to do mitigation is because management will say, well, what have you done about it? You say, well, we held these mitigation workshops, you see, and I'm also going to ask you for 12 new people in these disciplines, and I'm going to ask you to relax your rules. And he says, what do you mean, you relax my quality rules? No way. Oh, well, that was one thing that we shouldn't have gotten out of the mitigation workshop. But and by the way, the contingency is not just in terms of money or in terms of time. But right. if you have promised to give, let's say, a certain gas supply from this particular field to a particular customer or to the to a particular customer as of a certain date, that date had better be pretty solid for you, or you're going to have to buy it off the network at a high price in order to fulfill your contract. That's the sort of thing where, and by the way, there are some other things that we haven't talked about, and that is in the enterprise risk level. Things like the effect of certain actions, certain events on your reputation, on your company's brand, on your idea of how you get along with the world, And that often doesn't have anything to do at all with cost or schedule. So that's something that broadens us out quite a bit.
Yeah, so we kind of called it, I think what we used to call it was corporate risk, where, you know, it affects the brand or the local environment or the supply chain. Well, that's
any of these things, any of these things that go bad can affect you, and management of the company, management of the organization is going to be now. Obviously, if you take an extra 3 years to build a particular visible piece of property, you're going to be in trouble. But you're going to be in trouble in a lot of different dimensions, and some of those dimensions we're not even talking about here. Like cost and schedule is only two dimensions, and you've got these others that the management of the company really thinks about. And sometimes I think the management of the company will listen to the cost and schedule and talk about other things.
Yeah, no, that's great. I had one more for you while I got you, David, and this one's probably more prevalent to what I get asked more now. I work in consulting as well, and you know, you get a lot of clients, very different people with different attitudes and perspectives. But the one thing we can all agree on is, and I don't want to bring it up because it's probably the worst overused term in the world right now, which is COVID. But it does point to a very interesting point around risk and uncertainty. And let's say you've got a project. How do you factor? How would you suggest? I guess we don't have a crystal ball or anything, do we? So it really is just understanding.
That's one of the software packages. It's called Crystal
Ball. It's coming out. Stand by. We'll get you a discount. but you know, how do the risk team and the project teams then being asked by their senior execs to forecast projects, maybe particularly in construction where you've physically got to go out and you've got to interact. How do they forecast uncertainty at this level, this COVID kind of pandemic situation, which is causing lockdowns and shutdowns across construction?
Here I am in the United States, so I get our kind of take on it. I believe that even our national security people in Washington, D.C., at the Department of Defense and various other places, the CIA and all that, they were predicting a pandemic, a worldwide pandemic, as being a security risk. Now, they didn't know when it would happen, but they were saying, look, it is not impossible to happen, and you'd better be aware for an emergency. Here, as in more personal terms, I live in Los Angeles. And we have, what do you call them, earthquakes, we have mudslides, we have fires. Mm. And there have been plenty of people, including I've got a son who lives in Northern California, who's been ready to go because he's been advised that the evacuation might come to him. We were here and we could hear all the alarms and smell the smoke and all that. What is the likelihood of that's happened? And you change your behavior because of that. You get more insurance. You make sure that your house is secure. You behave differently. You certainly don't go out and light fires in the wilderness to burn your marshmallows on. So even there, I mean, and what do you do? I mean, we're involved with what do you do in the first hour of an earthquake? In the first hour of an earthquake, you try to figure out what resources do I have and all that sort of stuff. Who's vulnerable, particularly older people, for instance. What kind of thing might happen with respect to getting resources to people? And you usually use that in sort of a very local environment because you know that the police and the firemen, whom you usually rely on for some of these things, they're going to be busy elsewhere. So you've got to deal with it yourself. So emergency preparedness is one of the things that we do, and a lot of people are doing it now for these kinds of things that actually are very, very personal, not just COVID, but they're very personal to us. And in California, we have to deal with stuff like that. So our behavior does change, and the behavior changes for ways to, I mean, you know, we got a big stock of toilet paper, for instance. That's not a joke.
No, I believe you. And in the project environment, is there a way to anticipate this? Do you expect people should be super conservative when it comes to estimating uncertainty or providing a risk around the COVID
It really depends upon the consequence to you and the organization that you work for as to whether you do that. When it's not happening, it's relatively unlikely to happen, but the consequences can be fairly substantial. And on that heat map back in level two, we say, probability and impact. If the probability is low, but the impact is huge, like, for instance, you're a law firm, and if you do something in some way to anger your major client, all of a sudden, you got to let all the associates go, and all the partners have to do work again, that sort of thing. I once was going to Africa, and the doctor that was giving me my immunization said, "Oh, you don't need this one because, it's only one in 1,000 that you'll ever get this kind of thing." And, okay, so I'm faced with this, right? And it's a very personal decision on my part. And she says, it may sting and it's cost you $65. And I said, "Well, doctor, what you haven't told me is what are the consequences?" She said, "Oh, you die, but it's only one in 1,000. I said, "Right here, stick right here." I mean, it depends upon the consequence to you as to whether you behave differently. And it would have been wise for us to have in the United States, but in every country in the world these days, to have had a superstructure, an infrastructure rather, and information sources to identify and quickly deal with or quickly recognize the importance of COVID. And as I say, at some point we had that pegged as a strategic. A strategic risk, not just a health risk or public health risk, but a strategic risk with world powers. So that would have been well worth it if we'd kept that superstructure, that infrastructure going, and the kinds of plans that they could have on the shelf, the kinds of stored emergency kits, personal protective devices and masks and things like that that people could use. Ventilators, things like that. And there are people who think about it in these terms. That's a very small, very, very, very serious part of it. And it could be crucially difficult. I mean, you've got millions of people in the world dying from this thing.
Yeah.
It could be crucially difficult.
Yeah. I love the use of your real life examples there, David. And as Val says, there's so many questions I've been writing down, frantically, and I know Val has as well, and there's so much more we could ask you, but I just wanted to, as we head towards the end of the pod, just ask you one more question around risk, and that is around opportunities. Actually, in my experience, people find it so easy to come up with risks, what can go wrong, but when you ask them to list opportunities, it's silent, they struggle. What is your take on why perhaps, one, people struggle with opportunities, and two, how do opportunities fit in this whole risk and opportunity management realm?
Well, that's interesting. I've got now a very well developed, for my present project, very well developed risk registers, and they're all threats. You live in the UK. One of the people that's right around where you are is David Hilson, who has written about opportunities. And David Hilson is there in Peterborough, I think. And he has written books about it, and he understands it a lot more fundamentally. It is true that most of the things that I hear are threats. And always I start the interviews by saying, look, we want to talk about threats and opportunities because there may be something that we can pick off, low-hanging fruit that we can pick off the apple tree or things that we can, if we can make this happen, actually, it's better. I remember one case recently where there was a contractor doing major contracting work out of Korea, and we got their plan. This was a big oil project. We got their plan, and they said, "Now here's our plan, and here's what we've agreed to, but we think we can beat it by 2 months." And so all of a sudden, my eyes lit up, and I say, "Oh well, tell us about that. We really want to know." And under what conditions and what has to happen, and do we have to help you? Oh, no, we don't. We just think that there's a chance that we can beat it. and that this is maybe the worst we could have, then that's what's included in the plan. Okay, at that point, you say, well, my risk drivers work both ways. Not in all the software that I mentioned, but in the software that I like, the risk drivers can have multiplicative factors that are less than 1%, less than 100%, meaning that if that multiplicative factor happens, activities get shorter, right? And costs get lower. So we could do that. So we interviewed them about that, and we had on that particular project a really serious subcontractor who had told us that they thought that it was reasonable to think that they could knock 2 months off their schedule. And so it didn't make the project go faster. It made it not go so much faster, right? It offset some of the other things which were uniformly threats. So with some probability of occurring. But this had a fairly large probability of occurring, and, you know, 2 or 3 months could have been saved. And that project finished pretty much on time. So maybe they were able to do that.
Wow. Some really good insight there. And as you say, an hour's gone really quickly, and there's so much more. I just want to thank you for your time, and perhaps just come to you for a final thought that you want to leave the listeners with.
You've got to think about risk all the time. And you've got to think that if somebody tells you something is really literally going to happen, that maybe their head's in the sand a little bit, and that they really are denying something that they know, or denying something that they hope you don't know, that maybe there are politics involved and things like that, where it's in their best interest to make you think make you have a report that says they're in great shape, because they can take that to the boss and get an attaboy, and that's wonderful. And then they can, I've had people throw my report into the trash can, and I watched it happen. It was in a refinery project in Brazil, and they didn't like my answer, and they took it and they tossed in the trash can they paid my invoice, but they tossed in the trash can. And then, of course, in the first 6 months of that project, there was stuff happening that actually they lost about a year, maybe 6 months to a year in the first, everything is fine until you meet the enemy. And then all of a sudden everything goes up in smoke. And so I was right and they were wrong, but I couldn't tell them anything. I did have one project where the risk mitigation workshop was a disaster.
Yeah.
Where the project manager came in with all of his ideas, and he'd say, well, this risk that's 90% likely, it's only, we'll do this thing. It won't cost any money, but it'll reduce the probability to 5%. And the other 15 people in the room didn't say a word, because, of course, he's the boss. And so I had to write in my report that this whole exercise fell apart at the risk mitigation workshop. I claimed it was people's engineers' natural optimism, but in fact it was a project manager's doing this particular project. And I think he appreciated it later on, because he came in and said hello, and we had a good old talk. But he'd read my report by then. So.
Great.
Yeah, that's interesting to say that.
I agree, Vel. I agree. It's a great anecdote story to finish off on there. Okay. But yeah, thanks again, Dr. David Hewlett. Vel, any final thoughts from yourself?
No, other than it was really interesting to have someone so passionate about the profession in the risk area. We don't get a lot of risk guys on. I think, when was the last time we had a risk guy on? Let's season one, maybe.
Yeah, season one, and we're now in three.
Yeah. So it's great to have risk back at the forefront, which it should be. Again, I thought it was great that you mentioned AACE. I'm also a member of AACE in Australia here, regional chair for Victoria. So shout out to AACE for the good work that they are continuing to do in this profession, in this area. Obviously, we didn't get to all the questions, and if anyone wants to see more, they can catch your presentation. But over to you, Dale.
Cheers, Val. As you said, folks, that's all we have time for on this episode, but it doesn't have to stop here. Support our charities and access blogs at projectchatterpodcast.com. Don't forget to hit subscribe on our YouTube channel and your favorite podcast player so you don't miss the next one. Thanks again to Project Controls Expo for collaborating on this podcast. And don't forget to head over to projectcontrolexpo.com to register for the event. A massive thank you to Dr. David Hewlett for spending time with us today.
Thanks, Dave.
And thank you all for inviting me for this. No sweat, it's our pleasure. Till next time, we say stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. From me and Val, it's bye for now.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.